sources of the American intelligence community, including those at the behemoth Pentagon. In practical reality, he can only control the CIA's relatively modest budget. In the classified bureaucratic system that tried to define priorities for all government intelligence collection, targets were ranked in tiers. Late in 1998, Tenet designated the bin Laden threat as Tier Zero, the very highest. Yet few elsewhere in the scattered and balkanized intelligence bureaucracy took notice. The prioritization process was so broad and diffuse that it was worthless, some involved believed. The result was that an American government that spent hundreds of billions of dollars annually on defense and national security directed an infinitesimally tiny fraction of that money to disrupt and combat an enemy group identified by the CIA director as a mortal, even existential threat to the United States. Who, ultimately, was responsible? President Clinton had perhaps the greatest power to change these resource allocations. The Republican-controlled Congress was a close second. Tenet and other intelligence department heads had some discretionary power over the budgets they did possess. In hindsight, I wish I had said, "Let's take the whole enterprise down and put 500 more people there sooner," Tenet said later. But he did not. The practical result was that we never had enough officers from the Directorate of Operations, recalled one former chief of the CIA's counter-terrorist center. The officers we had were greatly overworked. We also received marginal analytic support from the Directorate of Intelligence. Tenet felt the CIA's budget needed an infusion of about $1 billion annually for at least 5 years, but when he advocated for these numbers at the White House and in classified hearings on Capitol Hill, he never got to first base. To wage even a modest war, it was usually necessary to fight with reliable allies. For nearly two decades, the CIA had been running covert action in Afghanistan through its liaison with Pakistani intelligence. To disrupt bin Laden's embedded network in Afghanistan and capture al-Qaeda's leaders, the agency would have to revive its partnership with Pakistan's ISI. Or, if this failed, the CIA would soon have to find another intelligence service to work with in Afghanistan's rough neighborhood. 24. Let's just blow the thing up. Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif lived in continual fear of his own army. Generals had invented the Sharifs as a political dynasty. They endorsed Nawaz as the civilian face of their favorite alliance, a center-right artifice of industrialists, landlords, Muslim clerics, and freelance opportunists. Sharif was attentive to his self-interest, if not always witting about how to secure it. He was presumed to be raking millions from Pakistan's treasury for his family's benefit. He also knew that any Pakistani politician, especially one hand-picked by the army, risked overthrow if the generals felt threatened by the civilians' independence or popularity. Sharif sought to forestall this fate by manipulating appointments at the top of the army command. He stacked the senior ranks with generals he believed were loyal to him and his family. The two crucial jobs were the chief of army staff, traditionally the top military job in Pakistan, and the position of chief spy, the director general of ISI. 2 months after the American cruise missile strikes in Afghanistan, Sharif fired his army chief. Jahangir Karamat was a secular thinker who supported civilian-led democracy. Yet Sharif interpreted speeches that Karamat had made about civil-military relations as portents of an army-led coup. Later it became clear that Sharif had badly misread the situation. Still, in typical style, the Prime Minister plunged ahead. He named Pervez Musharraf, a little-known general with a liberal reputation, to head the army. Although he had no intimate relationship with Musharraf, Sharif let it be known in the Pakistani press that Musharraf was his personally chosen general, his protege. This was a public relations blunder that ensured Musharraf would distance himself from Sharif, at a minimum to preserve his credibility with other generals. At the same time, Sharif appointed General Khwaja Ziauddin as the new chief of Pakistani intelligence. This, too, was an overtly political decision. Ziauddin had made his career in the Engineering Corps, a section of the military that rarely produced army leaders. But he had married into a wealthy, connected family in Lahore, and he was a frequent social visitor at the sprawling model town estate of Nawaz Sharif's influential father. It was a violation of army protocol for a rising general to allow himself to become visible socially, especially under the wing of a civilian political family like the Sharifs. Still, Sharif's father tapped Ziauddin as a favored brigadier, and he won an appointment to army headquarters, where he worked with the country's top-secret nuclear program. When Sharif sent him in the fall of 1998 to run ISI, Ziauddin was widely regarded as an emissary and protector of the prime minister. Sharif hoped to further defend himself from his army by drawing close to the Clinton administration. This was by now an old tactic of weak civilian prime ministers in Pakistan. Bill Clinton seemed to have a soft spot for Sharif. They had spent long hours on the telephone in the spring of 1998 when Clinton unsuccessfully sought to persuade the prime minister to forego nuclear weapons tests in response to a surprise test by India. But many of Clinton's senior aides and diplomats, especially those who knew Pakistan well, regarded Sharif as an unusually dull, muddled politician. He seemed to offer a bovine, placid gaze in private meetings, where he sometimes read awkwardly from note cards. Still, Sharif tried to make himself indispensable in continuing American-led talks over the region's nuclear crisis. Now there was suddenly another way for Sharif to make himself useful to the Americans. He could aid the secret effort to capture or kill Osama bin Laden. The new U.S. ambassador to Pakistan was a lively career diplomat named William Milam, an ambassador previously in crisis-ridden Liberia and Bangladesh. A mustached, suspender-snapping man with a pot belly and an easy laugh, Milam was accustomed to security threats and unstable politics, and he got along well with his CIA station chief, Gary Schroen. The pair opened private talks about bin Laden and Afghanistan with Musharraf and Ziauddin. The CIA hoped to persuade Ziauddin to betray bin Laden, to set him up for capture or ambush. The Islamabad station remained heavily invested in its tribal tracking force of former anti-Soviet mujahideen. Bin Laden was suddenly a much more difficult target, however. He moved frequently and unpredictably. After newspapers disclosed that the Americans had tapped his satellite telephone, bin Laden stopped using it, making it harder still to track him. Schroen and other CIA officers concluded that the best way to capture bin Laden was to enlist help from Pakistani intelligence officers who had his trust. They wanted ISI to lure him into a trap. Milam, Schroen, and their colleagues in the Islamabad embassy found Ziauddin a straightforward, accessible character. The new Pakistani intelligence chief was a stocky man, about 5 feet 9 inches tall, and his face looked as if it had been boxed around in a few fights. He was not shy, as some generals were, about talking openly with the CIA about Pakistani politics. He also acknowledged that neither he nor Sharif could work their will down the ranks by just snapping their fingers. He wanted to cooperate closely with the CIA and the Americans where he could, Ziauddin said, but the CIA would have to understand what was politically feasible in Pakistan. By the fall of 1998, CIA and other American intelligence reporting had documented many links between ISI, the Taliban, bin Laden, and other Islamist militants operating from Afghanistan. Classified American reporting showed that Pakistani intelligence maintained about 8 stations inside Afghanistan, staffed by active ISI officers or retired officers on contract. CIA reporting showed that Pakistani intelligence officers at about the colonel level met with bin Laden or his representatives to coordinate access to training camps for volunteer fighters headed for Kashmir. The CIA suspected that Pakistani intelligence might provide funds or equipment to bin Laden as part of the operating agreements at these camps. There was no evidence that ISI officers worked with bin Laden on his overseas terrorist strikes, such as the embassy bombings in Africa. The reported liaison involved Pakistan's regional agenda, bleeding Indian forces in Kashmir and helping the Taliban defeat Massoud's Northern Alliance. American intelligence analysts assumed that it was very difficult for ISI headquarters in Rawalpindi to control officers who worked inside Afghanistan. There seemed little reason to hope that Nawaz Sharif, nervous as a cat around anyone in his military, could easily issue orders to undercover colonels in Afghanistan. Nor was Ziauddin, with no background in intelligence and a reputation as Sharif's lackey, likely to exercise uncontested control. Senior Clinton administration officials who consumed this classified reporting about Pakistan intelligence officers in Afghanistan assumed, as one of them put it later, that those ISI individuals were perhaps profiteering, engaged in the drug running, the arms running. Not only was Ziauddin probably unable to control them, but headquarters, to some extent, probably didn't know what they were doing. At the same time, these Pakistani intelligence officers clearly were following orders from Islamabad in a broad sense. In their use of jihad to extend Pakistan's influence east and west, they had full backing from their country's army and from sectors of the civilian political class. The policy of the government, never declared, particularly in Kashmir, was to foster guerrilla warfare, recalled one American official who regularly read the CIA's reporting that autumn. Ziauddin and his senior colleagues, as well as their colonels on the ground, thought they were carrying out the overall policy of their government. At the White House, Clinton's senior foreign policy team saw an incredibly unholy alliance that was not only supporting all the terrorism that would be directed against us, but also threatened to provoke a nuclear war in Kashmir. Still, it was possible that Ziauddin would cooperate on bin Laden, CIA officers believed. Perhaps he or his men would help sell bin Laden out for money. Perhaps they could be persuaded of the political benefits to Pakistan. If bin Laden were removed as an impediment, the United States might eventually recognize the Taliban as Afghanistan's rightful government. That, in turn, would crown a decade of covert Pakistani policy in the region and put India on the defensive. Although they were careful not to put it so bluntly, the Americans told Sharif's generals that the army could better achieve its regional military aims if it betrayed bin Laden than if it stuck with him. Schroen's main operations proposal was simple. Pakistani intelligence would schedule a meeting with bin Laden at Kandahar's airport. ISI officers would tell bin Laden that they had a message for his eyes only. The CIA would then put its tribal agents into position on the long, open desert road to the airport. There was only one way in and out, and it would be relatively easy to set up the ambush. A senior ISI officer might fly into Kandahar for the supposed meeting. When bin Laden failed to turn up, the Pakistani officer could just shrug his shoulders and fly back to Islamabad. Ziauddin took in the CIA's proposal with apparent interest. He said that he would consult with Sharif and others in Pakistani intelligence to see if the trap could be arranged. Days later, he reported back. Impossible. The politics were just too hot, he told the Americans. If the ambush failed and the plan was exposed, Pakistan would pay too high a price with the Taliban, with Islamist politicians and army officers in Pakistan. If Pakistani intelligence was going to cooperate with the CIA to capture bin Laden, they would have to come up with a different approach. Ziauddin had his own ideas about that. Nawaz Sharif flew to Washington in early December 1998 to meet with President Clinton. Ziauddin came along as an undeclared senior member of the Pakistani delegation. The trip had been designed in part to boost Sharif's political standing at home by showing that he was close to Clinton and could obtain benefits for Pakistan from his friendship. Clinton had agreed to waive certain trade sanctions and to announce the release of about $500 million in Pakistani funds frozen by the United States in 1991 because of the nuclear issue. Clinton, Albright, and Berger met with Sharif, Ziauddin, and other Pakistani officials in the Oval Office for a scripted meeting at 1:30 p.m. on Wednesday, December 2, 1998. Clinton made clear that the issue he cared most about was Pakistan's nuclear weapons program. The president's college friend, Strobe Talbot, now Deputy Secretary of State, ran the ongoing talks with Pakistan and India, trying to persuade them to freeze or dismantle their bomb programs. In the Oval Office that afternoon, as the Americans read out their formal talking points, "The number one issue on our agenda," as National Security Council staffer Bruce Rydell put it, "was Pakistan's nuclear program. Second on the list was Pakistan's economy. Clinton hoped that free trade would help lift Pakistan out of poverty and debt, easing its chronic political and social crises. Third came terrorism and bin Laden. Clinton repeatedly signaled to Pakistan's highest leadership that bin Laden was a lesser priority than nuclear proliferation. Pakistan's army saw its confrontation with India as a matter of national life or death. Compromise on either the nuclear issue or the use of jihadist guerrillas to tie down India's large army would mark a sharp change in Pakistani strategy. With the stakes so high, anything second on your list was not likely to get the general's attention, as a White House official recalled. American officials ranking in the second tier sometimes met with Pakistani counterparts to talk forcefully and solely about bin Laden. But when Clinton himself met with Pakistani leaders, his agenda list always had several items, and bin Laden never was at the top. Afghanistan's war fell even lower down. The group meeting lasted that afternoon for 30 minutes. By prior arrangement, Sharif asked for time alone with Clinton. They met one-on-one for 20 minutes in the Oval Office. It was here, participants in the group meetings were told afterward, that Sharif first raised a proposal that Pakistani intelligence might, with CIA assistance, train a secret commando team for the purpose of capturing Osama bin Laden and bringing him to justice, as the American side put it. The Pakistanis had not been told about the CIA's Afghan tracking team. They were proposing a larger, more formal commando unit drawn from recently retired members of the Special Services Group, Pakistan's elite Special Forces unit. As enlisted men, sergeants, and a few officers retired from the SSG, they could be placed on contract and sent directly to the new bin Laden strike force. Their skills and training would be fresh. Clinton made clear that he expected his aides to follow up on the offer, to put the plan into motion. "We tried to get the Pakistanis involved in this, realizing that it was a difficult thing for them," Clinton said later. "They had both the greatest opportunity, but the greatest political risk in getting him," Clinton believed. They discussed bin Laden again over lunch. Sharif joked that the Americans had wasted their money by launching so many expensive cruise missiles at the Saudi fugitive. They should just have sent a few men into Afghanistan with briefcases full of dollars, and they would have gotten the job done, Sharif said. The Pakistanis offered an intelligence report. Bin Laden, they said, appeared to be seriously ill. Their information was that bin Laden suffered from kidney disease, and that his illness might explain why he had recently disappeared from public view. That day and afterward, the Americans were never sure what to make of these reports and similar ones relayed by Saudi intelligence about bin Laden's supposed poor health. A few thought the reports might be plausible. Others dismissed them as deliberate misdirection. Across the lunch table, the two sides exchanged their familiar stalemated opinions about the Taliban and Afghanistan. Albright said the United States had very serious problems with the Taliban, including their treatment of women and children. Sharif repeated his usual formulation. Pakistan itself was a victim of Afghanistan's unfinished war, especially its spillover effects, such as refugees and drug trafficking. Pakistan, too, was a victim of terrorism, he said. Berger and Albright both told Sharif that of primary importance to the U.S. government is the expulsion of Osama bin Laden from Afghanistan so that he can be brought to justice. Sharif rounded out his American visit with a few speeches and flew home. Later, many of the Americans involved said they were deeply cynical about Pakistan's proposal for joint covert action. They thought Sharif was just trying to cook up something that would distract the Americans and shut them up about bin Laden. They did not believe, they said later, that Pakistani intelligence would ever take the risk of ordering the commando team into action. If Pakistani intelligence wanted to help the CIA capture bin Laden, they did not need an expensive commando team to get it done, many of the Americans involved believed. They could just tell the CIA reliably where bin Laden was, and the United States would strike either with cruise missiles or with a kidnap operation mounted by its Afghan agents. The Americans repeatedly asked ISI for this sort of intelligence on bin Laden, and they were repeatedly rebuffed. Pakistani intelligence officers sometimes complained to the CIA in private that bin Laden now distrusted them. As a result, the Pakistanis said, they did not have the ability to track bin Laden's movements or predict his whereabouts effectively. The Americans doubted this. Even if bin Laden was now more wary of ISI than in the past, Pakistani intelligence had so many allies in the Afghan-rooted Islamic networks that it could easily set up bin Laden if its officers had the will to do so, they believed. Pakistan's army and political class had calculated that the benefits they reaped from supporting Afghan-based jihadist guerrillas, including those trained and funded by bin Laden, outstripped the costs, some of Clinton's aides concluded. As one White House official put it bluntly, "Since just telling us to fuck off seemed to do the trick, why should the Pakistanis change their strategy?" Sandy Berger, his deputy Jim Steinberg, Richard Clark, and George Tenet discussed their options. The consensus among them was that the Pakistanis had neither the ability nor the inclination to carry the commando plan through, as one official put it. On the other hand, what was the downside? The CIA would be out a few $100,000 on salaries for some retired Pakistani soldiers, plus the costs of training and equipment. Small change. The commando project could provide a vehicle for deepening contacts and trust among CIA officers, Ziauddin, and other officers in Pakistani intelligence. This could be useful for intelligence collection and, potentially, unilateral recruitments by the CIA. And even if the chances that the commando team would be deployed against bin Laden were very small, less than 1%, the most cynical of the Americans estimated, they had to try every conceivable path. The White House approved the plan some months later. Through the Islamabad station, the CIA paid salaries and supplied communications and other gear, as directed by Ziauddin. As it turned out, even the most cynical Americans were perhaps not cynical enough about Ziauddin's motivations. On paper, the CIA-funded secret commando team was being trained for action against bin Laden in Afghanistan. But Ziauddin later demonstrated that he saw another role for the unit, as a small, elite strike force loyal to Pakistan's prime minister and his intelligence chief. If the army ever moved against Sharif, the prime minister would have a secret bodyguard that might be called in to help defend him. Nor did ISI change its conduct on the Afghan frontier. Just weeks after the Oval Office meeting, white land cruisers pulled up at the darkened Peshawar compound of Abdul Haq, the anti-Soviet Afghan commander and estranged former CIA client. Now a businessman in Dubai, Haq had begun to organize anti-Taliban opposition among prominent Pashtun tribal families, such as his own. Pakistani intelligence had warned him to stop making trouble, but Haq had persisted. Ever since his first meeting with CIA Station Chief Howard Hart, he had seen himself as an independent leader, disdainful of the manipulations of ISI. That night, January 12, 1999, mysterious assailants smothered Haq's bodyguards, entered his home, and murdered his wife and children. Haq's aides investigated the case and concluded that the attack had been organized with help from Pakistani intelligence. Pakistani police made no arrests. The former American ambassador to the Mujahideen, Peter Thompson, who remained close to Haq, later reported that the killers had been trained at the Taliban intelligence school, supported by bin Laden, at Ternak Farm. This was the war as many Afghans who challenged the Taliban knew it. It was not a war in which ISI cooperation against bin Laden seemed remotely plausible. By contrast, as far as these Afghans could tell, those who openly defied bin Laden or Pakistani intelligence risked everything they had. Within weeks of Sharif's visit to Washington, the CIA station in Islamabad received its most promising report on bin Laden's whereabouts since the August cruise missile strikes. In early February 1999, agents in Afghanistan reported that bin Laden had traveled to Helmand Province in southern Afghanistan to join an encamped desert hunting party organized by wealthy Bedouin sheikhs from the Persian Gulf. The CIA sent its tracking team on the road, equipped with sighting equipment, satellite beacons to determine GPS coordinates, secure communications, and other spy gear. They raced out on the nomad highways that snaked through the barren desert. By February 9, the team reported to the Islamabad station they had found the hunting camp. It was an elaborately provisioned place far from any city, but near an isolated airstrip big enough to handle C-130 cargo planes. The camp's tents billowed in the wind, cooled by generators and stocked with refrigerators. The tracking team reported that they strongly believed they had found bin Laden. He was a guest of the camp's Arab sheikhs, they reported, and it looked as if he would be staying for a while. There would be plenty of time to bomb the camp with precision weapons, or to launch cruise missiles from ships or submarines in the Arabian Sea. Bin Laden had grown up in Bedouin tradition. Falcon hunting, especially for the elusive Hubara bustard, had been a passionate and romanticized sport in Saudi Arabia and neighboring kingdoms for generations. Each year, Arab sheikhs with the money to do so chased the Hubara across its winter migration route. Pakistan granted special permits to the visiting Arab sheikhs, dividing its northern hills and southwestern deserts into carefully marked zones where rival royals pitched their tents and sent their falcons aloft. One of the most passionate hunters was Sheikh Khalifa bin Zayed Al Nahyan, the billionaire crown prince of Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. Equally devoted was Sheikh Maktoum, the leader of Dubai, another emirate in the oil-rich confederation. Scores of other fabulously rich UAE notables flew to Pakistan each season to hunt. So entrenched did the alliance with Pakistan around Hubara hunts become that the Pakistani Air Force agreed secretly to lease one of its northern airbases to the United Arab Emirates so that the sheikhs could more conveniently stage the aircraft and supplies required for their hunts. Pakistani personnel maintained the airbase, but the UAE paid for its upkeep. They flew in and out on C-130s and on smaller planes that could reach remote hunting grounds. Some of the best winter Hubara grounds were in Afghanistan. Pakistani politicians had hosted Arab hunting trips there since the mid-1990s. They had introduced wealthy sheikhs to the leadership of the Taliban, creating connections for future private finance of the Islamist militia. Bin Laden circulated in this Afghan hunting world after he arrived in the country in 1996, so the CIA report that he had joined a large stationary camp in western Afghanistan that winter seemed consistent with previous reporting about Bin Laden. The CIA's tracking team marked the hunting camp with beacons and obtained its GPS coordinates. They began to watch on the ground from a safe distance. At Langley, the counter-terrorist center immediately ordered satellite coverage. Photographs of the billowing tents unspooled daily in the secure communications vault in the Islamabad embassy. The pictures confirmed what the agents had reported from the ground. Working closely with the counter-terrorist center, the Islamabad station reported, "It's still a viable target." Richard Clark, Sandy Berger, and a few White House aides with the highest security clearances reviewed the satellite pictures and the reporting from the Trodpine tracking team. Along with senior managers at the CIA, they began to fire questions back to the Islamabad station. Which tent is he in? What time of day is he in the tent? Where does he go to pray? Bin Laden was reported to visit frequently a camp next to the main hunting camp. The CIA radioed the tracking team that was hovering near the camp, asking for answers. One person involved remembered that the CIA actually identified the specific tent where they believed Bin Laden was sleeping. Still, Clark worried that the sightings by the Afghan tracking team might not be reliable. They were roaming far from their home territory. Clark told Deputy National Security Advisor Donald Kerik on February 10 that the Pentagon might be able to launch cruise missiles the next morning, but that other options, possibly involving a special forces raid, would take longer. The questions kept pouring into the Islamabad station. Langley and the White House wanted more precision. Days passed. Some of the CIA officers involved thought the evidence was very solid, good enough to shoot. As the questions seeking more targeting detail poured across their computer screens, Islamabad Station Chief Gary Schroen and his case officer colleagues began to ask sarcastically, "What is it going to come down to? When is he going to take a leak?" The feeling of some of the officers involved was, as Schroen put it, "Let's just blow the thing up. And if we kill Bin Laden and five sheikhs are killed, I'm sorry. What are they doing with Bin Laden? He's a terrorist. You lie down with a dog, you get up with fleas." Support for a missile or bombing strike was especially passionate inside the Bin Laden unit at the counter-terrorist center in Langley. This was their life. They felt Bin Laden had the United States in his sights. They came in every morning to new in-trays full of threat reports. They had been down this road of near misses too many times before. They wanted to shoot. Years later, recollections differed about exactly when and how it first became apparent that the hunting camp had been organized by royalty from the United Arab Emirates. Several officials remembered that the satellite photography showed a C-130 on the ground near the camp and that the plane was painted in a camouflage pattern used by the UAE Air Force. One participant recalled that the satellite photos also captured a tail number on the C-130 that was eventually traced to the UAE government. Richard Clark knew the UAE royal family very well. He had worked for years with the UAE's intelligence service, as well as its royal family and military. He negotiated arms deals and basing agreements, and he exchanged occasional tips and favors with the UAE security services. He had just returned from the country, where he had held talks on terrorism and arms purchases. The likelihood that UAE royalty were on the ground raised the stakes mightily. The Emirates were crucial suppliers of oil and gas to America and its allies. They cooperated with the American military on basing agreements. The port of Dubai received more port calls by the U.S. Navy than any port in the region. It was the only place in the Persian Gulf that could comfortably dock American aircraft carriers. The UAE royal family had also been targeted by the Clinton administration's Buy American campaign to win overseas contracts for weapons manufacturers and other corporations. And Sheikh Zayed had come through in a very big way. In May 1998, in a deal partially smoothed by Clark, the UAE had agreed to an $8 billion multi-year contract to buy 80 F-16 military jets. The contract would enrich American defense companies. The planes were to be manufactured in Texas, creating good jobs in a politically crucial state. If the United States bombed the camp and killed a few princes, it could put all that in jeopardy, even if bin Laden were killed at the same time. Hardly anyone in the Persian Gulf saw bin Laden as a threat serious enough to warrant the deaths of their own royalty. They would react to such a strike angrily, with unknown consequences for the United States. And if it turned out that bin Laden was not in the hunting camp after all, the anti-American reaction would make the controversy over the cruise missile strike on the Al-Shifa plant in Sudan the previous summer seem mild by comparison. All this was discussed at the White House just 2 days before President Clinton faced a final vote on impeachment charges in the U.S. Senate. It seemed clear that Clinton would win the trial and finish out his term, but his power had fallen to its nadir. This hardly seemed an ideal time for an all-or-nothing attack against a terrorist who made few Americans feel directly menaced. Some of the CIA officers involved could not understand the White House's hesitation. The CIA's reporting, human agents, the tracking team outside the camp, the satellite photography, signals intelligence, left some officers involved with an unusually high feeling of certainty that bin Laden was really there. It was rare to see bin Laden sit still in one place for so long. Some in the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad speculated that perhaps the recent Pakistani report about bin Laden's illness was truthful, and bin Laden had traveled to the luxurious camp to recuperate. Neither the Islamabad station nor the counter-terrorist center at Langley could offer a 100% guarantee that bin Laden was in the hunting camp, however. They did not have a picture of bin Laden standing outside his tent. The satellites could not take a photograph of that quality, and the tracking team could not get close enough. If they launched a strike, they would have to accept some doubt. George Tenet, for one, was not convinced that the reporting was completely solid. The U.S. military relied heavily on its alliances with the wealthy Persian Gulf Emirates, despite their occasional support for Islamists. To even consider a strike against bin Laden, they needed to be completely sure, some of those involved argued. In the American military, recalled Gary Schroen, nobody wanted to say, well, you blew up a camp full of UAE princes and half of the royal family of the UAE's dead, and you guys didn't get him. Clinton's National Security Cabinet had been tracking the camp for more than a week. They had learned what they could. They had to decide. Richard Clark recommended against a cruise missile shot. George Tenet, too, recommended no. By February 12, the day of Clinton's acquittal on impeachment charges, bin Laden reportedly had left the camp. Afterward, the U.S. Embassy in Abu Dhabi, capital of the UAE, contacted Sheikh Zayed's government and asked for precise coordinates of the family's Afghan hunting camp. The aviation maps and other data supplied through the UAE Foreign Ministry confirmed that it had been the royal family's camp. The UAE later reported to the White House that no members of the royal family had been present at the hunt, and that, as far as they could determine, bin Laden had not been there either. The Americans later concluded that high-level UAE officials had, in fact, been at the camp, which was quickly torn down in March after Clark called UAE officials. The call angered some CIA officers who had hoped to watch the camp quietly, hoping bin Laden would return. The U.S. Embassy in Abu Dhabi began pressuring the royal family to cease its hunting trips altogether. The Americans argued that the trips violated United Nations sanctions meant to isolate the Taliban. Based on United Nations and other reporting, the Americans also suspected that the C-130s flying out of Dubai carried weapons to the Taliban. The UAE government was one of three in the world that recognized the Taliban, yet its officials told the Americans that they wanted to cooperate and wanted to know what they could do to help, recalled a State Department officer involved in relaying the map data about the Afghan hunting camps. For its part, the UAE was anxious to make sure the data it handed over were properly entered into American targeting computers. The royal family had its own concern in the aftermath of Al-Shifa about making sure their camps were properly understood, the state official recalled. For some of the ground-level officers involved in the bin Laden chase, the decision to hold fire seemed almost unforgivable. It had been one thing before the Africa Embassy bombings to have their plan to raid Tanakh Farm and kidnap bin Laden turned down. That plan contained a great deal of risk and uncertainty. But with the desert camp, recalled Schroen, reflecting the views of other officers as well, we knew he was there. We had assets in place. There was little risk to life and limb to anybody. Not our Afghan colleagues, nobody on the American side. And it would have been, we thought, definitive. We could take him out. Yeah, some of these other people would be killed, but we would really be able to take him out. Some of them blamed Clark, speculating that he was so close to the UAE royal family because of defense deals he had previously negotiated that he would never take the risk of offending them. The cycle of frustration repeated itself that May. A CIA source reported with unusual specificity about bin Laden's movements and sleeping patterns over 5 nights in Kandahar. A cruise missile attack was again prepared. The National Security Cabinet again discussed whether they had enough intelligence to fire and whether the risk of civilian deaths was too great. As the White House hesitated, Mike Scheuer, the discouraged chief of the counter-terrorist center's bin Laden unit, wrote to a colleague in the field that having a chance to get UBL 3 times in 36 hours and foregoing the chance each time has made me a bit angry. The DCI finds himself alone at the table, with the other principals basically saying, we'll go along with your decision, Mr. Director, and implicitly saying that the agency will hang alone if the attack doesn't get bin Laden. For his part, even when he knew more or less where bin Laden might spend the night, Clinton remembered how he had been told that bin Laden would attend a leadership meeting in eastern Afghanistan just after the Africa Embassy bombings, and yet he left a couple of hours before the missile struck. As new single-threaded reports of bin Laden's whereabouts arrived, Clinton remembered, so what did I have? A 40% chance of knowing we could have hit it. Around this time, Scheuer fired off more emails protesting the agency's heavy reliance on its liaison with untrustworthy allies in the Persian Gulf. The bin Laden unit leader personified the single-minded passion that prevailed inside the counter-terrorist center's partitioned office suite. He was a disheveled, blunt, undiplomatic career officer who felt the United States ought to kill Osama bin Laden as a matter of the greatest urgency. The White House sometimes complained to Tenet that Scheuer was not well suited to manage the bin Laden group. He was too myopic in his approach. The email exchanges Scheuer generated after the hunting camp incident were angry, unusual, and widely circulated, according to one person who read them. During his 3 years in the bin Laden unit, Scheuer said later, he believed the CIA's Directorate of Operations was the only component of the intelligence community that could be said to have been waging the war that bin Laden declared against the United States in August of 1996. The rest of the CIA and the intelligence community looked on our efforts as eccentric and at times fanatic. Afterward, Scheuer transferred to another position at Langley headquarters. In the heavily compartmented CIA, where by careful design officers knew little about one another's work, his colleagues could not be sure exactly what had happened. But among at least a few of them, a belief settled in that Scheuer had been exiled, in effect, for becoming too passionate about the bin Laden threat, too angry about the failure to attack at Ternak Farm and at the desert hunting camp. Tenet did not widely explain his reasoning. He made clear years later that in every case where Clinton's cabinet discussed cruise missile strikes, a decisive problem was the lack of absolute certainty that bin Laden was present. Tenet concluded that the CIA's strategy against bin Laden had to be re-examined. Early in 1999, Tenet ordered the Counterterrorist Center to begin a baseline review of the CIA's operational strategy against bin Laden. He wanted the entire operation turned upside down, looked at from fresh angles. From the White House, Clark lobbied Tenet for change, arguing that neither Scheuer at the bin Laden unit nor senior managers such as Paul Pillar were the right leaders for a campaign against bin Laden. Within months, Tenet had dispatched a fast-track executive assistant from the 7th floor, a traditional breeding ground of CIA leadership, to replace Scheuer in the bin Laden unit. When the Counterterrorist Center's director Jeff O'Connell rotated out of his position, he soon became the CIA station chief in Tel Aviv, Tenet had another opportunity to shake things up. Who would know better how to get after Osama bin Laden, or be better motivated to break the stalemate, than a CIA officer bin Laden had once tried to kill? 25. The Manson Family. By early 1999, George Tenet believed that bin Laden could strike the United States again at any time. There was not the slightest doubt that bin Laden was planning new attacks, Tenet said. The CIA director issued this warning in public and in private. He saw evidence that bin Laden had contacts inside the United States. Tenet anticipated bombing attempts with conventional explosives, he told Congress and the White House. Bin Laden's operatives were also capable of kidnappings and assassinations. He worried that Al-Qaeda might acquire and use weapons of mass destruction. Tenet believed a chemical or biological attack by bin Laden or his allies was now a serious prospect. Tenet grew frustrated by the on-and-off attention paid to the Al-Qaeda threat within Clinton's cabinet. He spent weekends watching his son play soccer in the suburbs, and he complained to his CIA colleagues that the administration's bin Laden policy sometimes seemed like two-year-olds playing soccer. They all go to the ball. Then their interest would wane, and they would run to the other side of the field to chase something else. Yet for all his stark warnings, the CIA director did not describe bin Laden in 1999 as the gravest, most important threat faced by the United States. Like the president he served, Tenet worried most about the global spread of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, and of the missiles that could deliver them to the American homeland. When he inventoried the threats faced by the United States, Tenet listed bin Laden second, after the proliferation of unconventional weapons. In a 97-paragraph unclassified statement he issued that winter about rising dangers in an unstable world, Tenet devoted 4 paragraphs to bin Laden. Also, the CIA director placed virtually no emphasis on Afghanistan as a cause or context of bin Laden's menace. Tenet never said publicly that bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were a powerful faction in Afghanistan's civil war, that they thrived on their links to Pakistani intelligence, or that they took succor from Saudi and Persian Gulf sheikhs and proselytizers. In the statement he issued that winter, for instance, Tenet only mentioned the Taliban in passing as a potential source of inspiration for Islamist extremists in Pakistan. He did not describe the Taliban as a threat to the United States or to stability in Central and South Asia, or as bin Laden's most important military allies. Years later, Tenet rued that among the daunting impediments facing the CIA's campaign against Al-Qaeda during 1999 was that U.S. policy stopped short of replacing the Taliban regime, limiting the ability of the U.S. government to exert pressure on bin Laden. But if Tenet felt frustrated by that policy at the time, or conceived alternatives to it, he did not say so in public, and did not press his views within the cabinet. Tenet had matured at Langley. and had succeeded in a job that had thwarted more experienced predecessors. By early 1999, he had proved himself an exceptional manager and leader of people, and he had won Clinton's personal confidence. Yet he remained, to some extent, the staff director he had been on Capitol Hill, a synthesizer and manager of other people's views. A profoundly visceral person, Tenet felt the bin Laden threat in his gut, and responded actively with warnings and exhortations to his covert action team at the counter-terrorist center. But Tenet seemed to accept the bin Laden problem on its received terms, as a traditional anti-terrorism or policing issue, best addressed by a lightning covert capture operation or a decapitating missile strike. As Tenet noted later, to confront bin Laden and the Taliban more broadly would have required a new foreign policy. More than a decade earlier, the passionate anti-communist William Casey had helped create and drive his president's global policies from Langley. That was not George Tenet's vision of himself or of the CIA. In shuffling his lineup at the Counterterrorist Center that spring of 1999, Tenet demanded a new, comprehensive operational plan of attack against bin Laden and his allies. The plan's purpose would be to capture and bring to justice bin Laden and his principal lieutenants. For this, the CIA needed better intelligence about bin Laden's movements. Tenet wanted more human sources in Afghanistan, deeper liaison with regional intelligence services, and more effective technical collection, including communications intercepts and satellite photography. The sense in Tenet's seventh-floor suite, as well as in the counterterrorism office at the White House, was that the CIA's counterterrorist center had grown too dependent on the gang of tribal agents in southern Afghanistan. One of Tenet's aides referred to them derisively as weekend warriors, middle-aged and now prosperous Afghan fighters with a few Kalashnikovs in their closets. The tribal agents were being asked to take on vicious, religiously motivated bin Laden bodyguards who would fight to the death. It was small wonder that the team was reluctant to attack. Their reporting about bin Laden's movements was very good, although often a day or two behind. The agents communicated reliably. As in the episode at the desert hunting camp, they were willing to take risks as a tracking team, spying on bin Laden from a distance. But it was too much to expect them to act as a decisive paramilitary force against al-Qaeda's hardened Arab killers, especially since the White House's rules of engagement cautioned them against indiscriminate attacks. Tenet's push for a new bin Laden plan emphasized operations, agent recruitment, risky insertion of technical collection equipment, paramilitary covert action. But the bin Laden tracking unit at the Counterterrorist Center was heavily staffed by analysts from the Directorate of Intelligence, not spies from the Directorate of Operations. That spring, 70% of the unit's professionals were women, and two-thirds had backgrounds as analysts. They could call on spies in the CIA's far-flung stations, but their own operating experience was limited. They were highly educated, worked unusually long hours, and had become fanatically motivated about the bin Laden threat. They studied bin Laden's fatwas, drew up elaborate charts of his international networks, scrutinized interrogation reports, and monitored the most obscure nuances in theological debates among Sunni Islamist extremists. They were a relatively junior group, with an average of 3 years' experience, as compared to the average of 8 years in the mainline Directorate of Intelligence. They struggled at times to persuade case officers in the Directorate of Operations to work on their requests. CIA field officers abroad did not like to take direction from the ladies working back at Langley, one counterterrorist center manager recalled. The bin Laden unit's analysts were so intense about their work that they made some of their CIA colleagues uncomfortable. The unit had about 25 professionals in the summer of 1999. They called themselves the Manson family because they had acquired a reputation for crazed alarmism about the rising al-Qaeda threat. Jonestown, said one person involved, asked to sum up the unit's atmosphere. I outlawed Kool-Aid. Some of their colleagues thought they had lost their perspective. It was a cult, recalled a second American official. There was frustration. Why didn't everybody else share their view on things? Tenet valued the bin Laden unit's intensity, but he needed a breakthrough. We have seen numerous reports that Bin Laden and his associates are planning terrorist attacks against U.S. officials and facilities in a variety of locations, including in the U.S., he told a closed Senate hearing on June 24. That spring, the director appointed one of his deputy's key executive assistants, known to his colleagues as Rich, to take charge of the Bin Laden unit. The new chief had worked as a case officer in Algeria during the early 1990s, in the midst of a gruesome uprising waged by violent Islamist radicals, some of them veterans of Afghanistan. He knew the Bin Laden issue. He knew the Third World, and he did not mind high-risk travel. Like his new colleagues, Rich was intense and sometimes emotional and combative. Since he came directly from Tenet's leadership group, his arrival was seen as a signal of renewed high-level interest in the Bin Laden case. The new chief's connections presumably would help attract resources to the cause and smooth decision-making. Tenet quickly followed this appointment with another. He named Kofor Black as director of the entire counter-terrorist center. It had been just 4 years earlier that Black had left Khartoum, Sudan. As station chief there, he had supervised intensive undercover intelligence collection operations against Bin Laden, chasing the Saudi and his men around in jeeps and cars. Black had disrupted rehearsals by Bin Laden's lieutenants to ambush and kill him on a road near the U.S. Embassy. He took the Bin Laden case personally. "This is bad business," Tenet told Black, as an official involved in the transition recalled. "These guys are getting stronger and stronger. We're going to get struck. We've got to engage this target. We've got to get more penetrations. We've got to go out after these guys." Black's bluff speech, vaguely British inflections, and love of warrior metaphors created a new table-thumping martial air at the counter-terrorist center. He and the new Bin Laden unit chief knew each other well from their years in the Directorate of Operations. They wanted to shake up the unit's strategy. Kofor Black was not a natural partner for Paul Pillar, the intellectual terrorism analyst who was the counter-terrorist center's long-serving deputy director. Pillar's emphasis on managing permanent terrorist threats and his skepticism about how the Clinton administration had personalized its campaign against Bin Laden stood in some contrast to Black's gung-ho ambitions. After years of exhausting, nerve-wracking service, Pillar soon left the center for a fellowship at a Washington think tank. Black and his new Bin Laden unit wanted to project into Afghanistan, to penetrate Bin Laden's Afghan sanctuaries. They described their plan as military officers might. They sought to surround Afghanistan with secure covert bases for CIA operations, as many bases as they could arrange. Then they would mount operations from each of these platforms, trying to move inside Afghanistan and as close to Bin Laden as they could get to recruit agents and to attempt capture operations. Sometimes they would work with regional intelligence services, Black announced. Other times, they would work on their own. They would not try to pick and choose their partners fastidiously. Black declared that he wanted to develop liaison operations especially aimed at agent recruitment with every intelligence service in the Middle East and South Asia that might possibly offer a way to get at Bin Laden and his lieutenants. 8 to 80, blind, crippled or crazy, we don't care what you are, we want to be in contact, Black told his colleagues. We are at war, declared a document presented to a closed counter-terrorist center meeting on September 10. They had to continue to sow doubt in Bin Laden's mind about the security of his operations, and Black did not want to sit around in restaurants and exchange written reports, the traditional emphasis of intelligence liaison. He wanted recruitments, and he wanted to develop commando or paramilitary strike teams made up of officers and men who could blend into the region's Muslim populations. Even with Tenet's support, they struggled for resources. In the same weeks that he began to talk at the White House, FBI, and Pentagon about what he called the plan for revived global operations against Bin Laden, Black was forced to implement a 30% cut in cash operating budgets at the counter-terrorist center, including in the Bin Laden unit. The CIA had started to reverse its decline in personnel, but by the end of 1999, it still had 25% fewer operations officers than it had fielded when the decade began. The annual cash crunch at the counter-terrorist center could often be partly offset by budgetary scavenging at the end of a fiscal year, but these were distracting and uncertain efforts. As he developed briefing slides for Tenet and the White House that summer, Black boasted that the plan was comprehensive, global, and newly ambitious. But his colorful slides masked a threadbare checking account. A study commissioned by Black and presented to a CIA conference on September 16, 1999, concluded that the Counterterrorist Center could not carry out its more ambitious plans against Al-Qaeda without more money and people. Worse, the geopolitical map that Black and the new bin Laden unit chief pored over did not look promising. Taliban-ruled Afghanistan was a denied area, in CIA parlance, with no secure bases for permanent operations. Pakistan seemed a highly unreliable partner, Black and the new bin Laden unit chief agreed. Pakistani intelligence was so penetrated by Taliban and bin Laden sympathizers, they believed, that there was little basis to rely on joint operations such as the commando training the CIA was providing. Iran shared a long border with Afghanistan, but was out of the question as a partner. Turkmenistan, another neighbor, wanted nothing to do with the CIA. A civil war engulfed Tajikistan to the northeast. That left only Uzbekistan, which bordered Afghanistan to the north, far from the southern and eastern Taliban strongholds where bin Laden mainly operated. But at least Uzbekistan's government was not penetrated by Taliban sympathizers, Black and his colleagues calculated. A jowly, secular ex-communist autocrat named Islam Karimov ruled the country as if it were his estate. Karimov jailed and sometimes tortured democratic and Islamist opponents. He had no sympathy for bin Laden. Karimov's hold on power was threatened by a violent radical group called the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan. Its leaders had been inspired by Saudi proselytizing and later found exile with bin Laden in Afghanistan. By 1999, bin Laden and the Taliban leadership saw these Uzbek Islamists as important allies. The IMU fought as committed shock troops in the Taliban's war against Massoud's forces in northern Afghanistan. They were also a vanguard of bin Laden's grandiose plans to sponsor a thrust by Islamist forces into Central Asia to overthrow the region's secular leaders and establish new caliphates. Bin Laden provided the Uzbek radicals with funding, weapons, and access to training camps. The Taliban provided them with bases and housing in Kabul and farther north. Uzbek terrorist units began to sneak across the border to mount operations against Karimov's government. On February 16, 1999, they announced themselves in the capital of Tashkent. As Karimov drove in a limousine to a cabinet meeting, the radicals detonated 6 car bombs in a downtown plaza. Karimov escaped, but 16 people died. Within days, Karimov arrested at least 2,000 Islamic activists. Many of these arrests were indiscriminate, sweeping up peaceful democratic parties challenging Karimov's iron-fisted rule. But Karimov described the crackdown as war against bin Laden's allies. Kofor Black and his colleagues saw this turmoil as an opportunity. Through the CIA station in Tashkent, they reached out to Karimov's government and proposed a new intelligence alliance focused on their mutual enemies in Afghanistan. Karimov wanted CIA assistance, but was nervous about the political price he might pay if his contacts with Langley became known. He agreed to explore the CIA's proposals, but insisted that all of his dealings be kept secret. Black and the new bin Laden unit chief, Rich, flew discreetly into Tashkent, a Soviet-style city of broad avenues and monumental government buildings in the Central Asian steppe, to outline a new CIA liaison program. Black proposed CIA funding and training for a counterterrorism strike force to be commanded by the Uzbek military. The CIA hoped the force, once fully trained and equipped, might carry out covert snatch operations against bin Laden or his lieutenants. Karimov accepted the plan. He made Uzbek air bases available to the CIA for small-scale transit and helicopter operations. He allowed the CIA and the National Security Agency to install monitoring equipment designed to intercept Taliban and Al-Qaeda communications. He agreed to share what intelligence his government had about bin Laden's bases in Afghanistan. Karimov and his aides hinted that they might be willing to join the CIA in military operations once the new commando force was ready. The CIA's officers were excited and optimistic. They admired Karimov's willingness to take political risks to go after bin Laden. Finally, they had found a new partner less penetrated than Pakistan and less complicated than Saudi Arabia. Karimov and his intelligence aides agreed to just